So welcome once again, everyone. This is the August edition of the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace at the University of Arkansas teleconference series. Each month, as you know, if you've been joining in these conversations as they've been developing, each month we are interviewing, having conversations with leaders from the worlds of academia, the business world, and the faith and spiritual traditions, always asking, kind of leaning into a broader question that generally follows the format of what can the world of business, the world of commerce, learn from the faith and spiritual traditions that will help those in the business world to do a better job of serving all stakeholders. And in light of that question, as a continuing conversation around those topics, I'm very pleased today to introduce our guest, Lynn Sedgemore. I'll tell you a little bit about Lynn. She is currently chief executive of the 157 Group and is advisor to the UK government cabinet office on a range of projects, including leadership, innovation, community cohesion, and preventing violent extremisms. She has chaired and sat on numerous UK national and ministerial public sector committees, was a key member of the Prime Minister's Review of Public Sector Leadership Development, and is currently a commissioner for the UK National Review on Community Colleges. Lynn was previously the chief executive of the UK Centre for Excellence in Leadership. And we're going to be talking more about that experience today, because it was during her tenure there in 2007 that the Center for Excellence in Leadership received the International Spirit at Work Award. And also, I want to let everyone know that Lynn will be one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming International Faith and Spirit at Work Conference in November at the University of Arkansas. We'll say a little bit more about that as we get into the program today. So, Lynn Sedgemore, welcome to the teleconference.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you.
And it's just a delight to be able to connect with you across the Atlantic and have you with us today. Impressive background. I have spent some time preparing for this call today, just reading a little bit about you and some of the work you've done. But there's one thing that I want to start out by asking you. I hope I don't put you on the spot too much, but I didn't mention this as part of your biographical sketch, but I have to ask you about one thing, because it sounds really impressive, and I want to know if it's as impressive as it sounds, and that's that you were awarded Commander of the British Empire by the Queen in 2004. Not being a British citizen, I'm not sure what that is. What is the Commander of the British Empire?
Okay, what that is, and there are various views about these things, is the Queen gives honours twice a year. She does it at New Year on the 1st of January, and she does it on her birthday. And there are really four levels of honours: an MBE, Master of the British Empire, then an OBE, Order of the British Empire, then a CBE, Commander of the British Empire, and then the next level is a knighthood or a damehood. So CBE is quite a senior honour. Yeah.
Yes. Well, congratulations. I appreciate
it. Well, as a working class kid off a council estate in England, which I am, to be honest, I accepted the honour not really for myself, but for my college and my students and for my mum and dad,
yeah,
who were thrilled a bit, if I'm really honest. Yeah.
Wow, that's tremendous. Well, congratulations on that. So the theme today is a big one, I think, and what I'd like to do is kind of start big, and with a rather broad question, and lean into it a little bit, and then from there lead into a conversation about how that broad question, or the answers to that broad question, sort of manifested themselves in the experience that you had as leader for the Center for the Center for Excellence in Leadership, and your tenure there, and also even the work you're currently doing. So it's kind of a broad question to an on the ground, how does that really show up kind of specific kind of conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
That feel all right to you?
Yeah, that's fine.
So here's the broad question. and will be kind of the theme for today's conversation, and that's this. What exactly do we mean? What exactly do you mean, or how do you understand it to mean when we say a spiritual organization? And as a piece of that, what does it mean to be a spiritual leader in an organization?
Okay. Yeah. I like those questions because one of the conversations I've had for a very long time, particularly when a chap called Michael Joseph undertook a five-year PhD on when I was principal of Guildford College, is what's the difference between a good leader without any spiritual dimension or doesn't consciously work with a spiritual dimension and a spiritual leader? I actually think it's three things, because I've thought about this a lot. My view is that an organisation or a leader who is spiritual is working consciously with the transcendent, whatever shape or form that transcendent means to them or manifests to them. So there is a sense that there is something more, and they consciously work with their state of being, mindfulness, presence, a sense of flow, energy, and a relationship with something bigger than themselves, whether that's a religious frame or a broader spiritual frame in terms of that. So that connection with, relationship with, experience of transcendence in whatever shape or form. So I think that's one strand. I think the second strand is that an organization and the leader or leaders within it are actively fostering and supporting the inner life of the staff and, if possible, their customers, in our case, our students, our learners. But you're supporting and fostering the inner life of people in that organization. And if they choose to and want to, they can step into their spiritual growth elements in a very conscious, overt way. And I can say more about that if that's interesting to people. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's a third strand that I've certainly encouraged as a chief exec in three organizations that I've led as CEO, is as a whole organization, consciously inquiring and developing the spiritual, faith, transcendent element as an organization. And what I mean by that is having quiet rooms, looking at the values and where a spiritual element links into that, looking at bringing perhaps spiritual values into policies and ways of working, and having collective inquiry spaces or collective corporate experiences that nourish the soul. So those are those three strands that I think are different than a very good humanistic leader who leads extremely well and also develops the potential of people. It's just that transcendent dimension that may not be present consciously.
From your experience, can you say anything about the results of if you just for a moment take what you described as a very good leader, a humanistic approach in an organization, versus how you've described a spiritual organization with a spiritual leadership model in place? Have you seen that? How would you contrast or compare the outcomes of those two different approaches?
Okay, I think there's something about what do the people who are in that organizational community and collective want? Mm. Yeah? So you get high performance from people for whom the transcendent element isn't essential. What I have found, though, is that in the organizations that I've been involved in, that people who are working in them begin to say, hey, I can bring all of myself into this organization. And I can actually now work and perform in a way that I'm enhancing what I'm doing. My passion is bigger. My sense of flow, and I've worked in organizations where we've consciously discussed the level of flow. By that, I mean where people are really at one with their work activities and almost kind of get lost in them and perform quite peak performances. And what they experience is a sense of satisfaction, of joy, of coming into the workplace on a whole new level of beingness, and that they perform better. In the Centre for Excellence, we did get researchers in who looked at the high performance element of our organisation and the well-being and the spiritual elements, and they did actually come to a conclusion that the two were supporting each other, and that people were performing quicker, they were performing at very high levels, they were loving what they were doing, they were highly creative and innovative. So that whole sense of extra dimension about who and how and what they could be was contributing to high performance. I do want to say, though, I think this invitational, it needs to be invitational in terms of how people engage with that. You can't force any of this on people. You can't make it something that you want them to do. I actually think it works when people are drawn to it and it really matters to them, mm-hmm. and it's all very inclusive and very open.
Mm-hmm. So let's take that now, that framework, and kind of go into the experience that you had at the Center for Excellence in Leadership as kind of a case study, perhaps, to where it's appropriate to do that, of what you were just talking about. So maybe lay the groundwork a little bit. First, tell us a little bit about what the center was, where the kind of organization it was, the kind of work it was doing, and kind of where it was functionally when you arrived, and some of the little bit of time we have to talk about. I'm sure we could spend days and weeks talking about everything, but some of what happened there, and why, and how, and the results that you
okay.
saw.
Okay. Well, the Centre for Excellence in Leadership was one of 11 public sector organisations that were established by the Prime Minister and senior ministers, the political ministers, to drastically improve public sector leadership. And CEL, if I can call it CEL, C-E-L, was the one for further education colleges. Now, when I inherited it, it's only been going for a year when I was appointed, it was a leadership organisation in quite strong disarray, that the partners were not working collectively together. It was not making any profit. It was actually losing money, and its customer satisfaction was about 75%. And it had had 90 leaders through in the first year. We were asked to bring 1,500 leaders through in 3 years. And basically, just to give you a sense of the output, we brought 40,000 through in 4.5 years. So we completely went off the scale in terms of our target. No other of the national leadership centres achieved to that level, although they were all successful in their own right. Our customer satisfaction went as high as 98%. So we were bringing massive volume through, but maintaining customer satisfaction. And we started to make $500,000 profit in the first year and got to making $1 million profit in subsequent years. So we were on every bottom line benchmark, we were way, way over the original target. When you measured us against others, we were really off the scale. And I think that related to when you looked at what we did that others didn't do, which our researchers did, we invested nearly £4,000 per year per head of staff, major staff investment. We enabled staff to do reflective skills. They all had a coach. They could have a mentor as well. They had 360-degree diagnosis, reflective tools. We used the Enneagram, we used NLP, we used other sorts. We had a quiet room. We took staff away on retreats where we literally said, let's nourish souls. So we did African drumming together. We did creative things together. So there was a whole dimension to the work of the Centre for Excellence and its work with staff, We also encouraged them to meditate, brought yoga teachers in. We basically said, whatever nourishes your inner life and your spiritual growth, we will support you in. And what we found was people appreciated that so much that their sense of giving back and the reciprocal giving and taking and being of service seemed to take on these extra dimensions in terms of nourishing the staff. So that in a nutshell is what happened. And we also did faith inquiries. We generated a faith literacy toolkit. We had Dignity at Work programs, collective spaces where people could talk about what it meant to have a faith in the workplace, what it meant to be agnostic. We had atheists. Mm-hmm. We were also very high on being supportive of all kinds of diversities. So we won the Stonehill. We were in the top 10 of the Stonehill Stonewall Awards for being gay-friendly. A whole range of things, and that raises huge debates in terms of the hierarchies of equalities and the different approaches to different kinds of equalities. So there was a whole arena of things happening, which staff always fed back and said that they valued this more than anything. And they were also very keen to perform and be successful. And we also did leadership programs on being present and mindful and being in the moment. So I hope that gives a flavor.
It does. It's a massive, amazing broad range of programs and offerings that you had going on. A couple of questions are popping into my mind as I'm listening to this, and one of them is when you look overall at the commitment to staff development, let's just call it that in a broader scope, and you look at the percentage of time and investment that was spent on those sorts of things you just described, let's call those spiritual development sorts of activities, how did that compare to other sorts of staff development that might have been more skill set oriented that we might typically find in an organization?
We did those as well. I believe that it's really important that staff are equipped with the skill base to be competent plus in the work that they do. So if staff were needing sales training or development and administrative skills or developmental elements for how they were developing the leadership programs, that was also provided. That would be part of this 4,000 a year allocation that staff got. Mm-hmm. So my sense is what we were doing was additional things on top of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, so many of our staff were highly competent. I think we began to attract and recruit into the organization people who got a feel of the culture. So we didn't really have a lot of issues around low performance, or those kinds of issues, which we did occasionally, but they tended to be dealt with through the peer route because people would support each other or point it out. Mm-hmm. So my sense is you're always supporting around the skills base as well as though enhancing those other aspects of what other people were really interested in.
So if we go back to a comment that you made earlier about your feeling that spiritual leadership needs to sort of, needs to be invited in by the people that you're leading. In other words, there needs to be a sense of some permission there or some openness to that direction. How did you know that was a direction that this particular staff was ready for and wanted to go in, needed to go in? How did you know that when you arrived and started thinking, okay, what do we need to do here to get this ship headed in the right direction?
One of part of my way, I can't help but want to share that added dimension because it so enhances my life, okay? And I think, particularly as a chief exec, there is a real issue about use of power in organizational life. Mm-hmm. and that if you are motivated and interested in the spiritual aspect, remember we were a public sector organisation. Mm-hmm. We reported into a Secretary of State who sits in the Cabinet Office of the Prime Minister, and this is not the norm. Yeah. In the UK civil service. So what we had to be really clear about was that we were hitting our targets, overperforming. We were good public servants, which we were, and there was this extra element. And we had to explain it at times, which wasn't easy. Yeah. They were always curious about us. They always like, there's something about you that's different, but look at your figures, look at your targets. And we're not sure about this other bit, but hey, and I actually believe that if you are in quite difficult environments that don't naturally accept and see spirituality as part of an organisational life, if you're not performing, you will be closed down, you know, or it will be challenged and it would be harder. So I have learned over a very long period that to be high performing, as an individual and as a collective and an organisation, does matter to be able to experiment. Uh-huh. So the way that I invite people, I share that this is an interest of mine. The way we did it in Guildford College was Michael Joseph came in and did a PhD, and again he did it in a very invitational inquiry. I think part of being a spiritual person is constantly inquiring, constantly reflecting, asking questions. I'm in the Diamond Heart, the Ridwan, a spiritual school, which is very much based on inquiry, constantly asking, reflecting. So I would ask people, are you interested in this? I mean, we did have 25 researchers at one point who were postmodernists, deconstructionists, who were not interested, I can tell you. But what I said is, let's have a debate about it. Let's have an inquiry into what this is doing for us positively or whatever. And they enjoyed the inquiry, even though quite a few of those were very anti any form of spiritual expression in an organisation. And in my organisations, if you don't want to engage, that's not an issue. That's not a problem. I don't think you can create an environment where people feel awful or excluded or lesser than if they don't participate. I think we were having so much fun a lot of the time. Why would you not?
they just had to pick up a drum and join in, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were 80 of us doing African drumming, and we got it all together in the second cycle. And the guy who does this in corporate organisations said he'd never got an organisation to do it in less than 5 cycles. And we did it in 2. And the other thing is, researchers who came in said the level of play and fun and creativity in that organisation was huge. We had a ball. I mean, and literally, we did have balls. We used to have themed evenings. We used to have our away days on boats on the river. We had one in a haunted house. We would have themed, you know, masked balls as well. We had serious fun, but it was all about getting better at serving the learners that we were serving, the 40,000. It wasn't just an end in itself. It was part of being better at what we did.
Right.
And you can do the both, I think. I think that was... And it was the junior staff who used to organise our away days. The younger staff, if you like, us oldies, wouldn't have had anywhere near the creativity that these young people brought to our away days. It was stunning.
Well, let me put a pause in there just for a second to let everybody know that we're going to be moving here in the next few minutes into a question and answer period. And I have to believe there's some questions or at least some comments or at least some folks wanting to say wow out there and share that with Lynn. So if you have something you'd like to share or ask, you can let me know that by hitting the star and then the number 5 on your phone. That's star 5. And that will raise a little electronic icon of a hand on my computer screen. I'll know that you're wanting to ask a question. I can call on you by unmuting you, and you can share with Lynn as we have her on the phone. So it's star five. And while we're pausing, I want to make a quick couple of other quick announcements before I forget to do it towards the end of the conference call. Lynn will be one of our keynote speakers at the International Faith and Spirit at Work Conference that's going to be held in Fayetteville at the University of Arkansas November 7th through 9th. And there's information, registration is now open for the conference. You can find full information and registration information on the website, which is TFSW, Tyson Faith Spirit Work, .uark, that's for University of Arkansas, uark.edu, tfsw.uark.edu. Also, I want to let you know that next month, on September 21st, we're going to be speaking with another one of the keynote speakers that will be at the conference, Bill Pollard, who is a former chairman of ServiceMaster, and going to be talking about his experience at ServiceMaster, some of the books he's written, including The Soul of the Firm, and other things. And I spent some time on the phone with Mr. Pollard last week, and he's just an absolutely delightful man. I'm really looking forward to next month's conversation as well. So plan on joining us for that. If you got word of this call by virtue of someone forwarding you the email and you'd like to join our mailing list, you can do that on the website that I mentioned a moment ago as well. So those are my announcements. We've got those out of the way. So if you've got a question, star five on your phone, and I'll call on you, unmute you, and you can talk directly to Lynn. Well, it's hard to, first, I want to make sure no one has missed a couple of things that you've said, and one being that this was not a private for-profit organization you were working for. This was a government agency. And I would say that you made a comment about this was not the norm for an agency like that in the UK. I will tell you it's not the norm for an agency like that in the US either. So to me, when I read your story and read the story of CEL, to see that you were able, that you were willing to take these sorts of risks and do the kind of work you did there inside what most of us would normally consider to be pretty restrictive environments, I found that pretty admirable. So was it a kind of a, I have to ask this, was it kind of a let's just do it first and ask permission later kind of a thing? Were you given enough latitude that you could just sort of start going down this road and trust that the performance figures would justify it later? How did you take the first steps?
I don't think I'm courageous at all. And one of the things I really had to do was have a coach who supported me through the trust element of this, because there was a huge risk in it. Mm. And basically, I mean, yes, I was the CEO, but this was a collective activity. I was only one of a whole series of people who contributed to sell success. So what began to happen is as I talked with people and we shared interests, it kind of became a collective desire to let's go for it, whatever it meant. So what we began to do, and one of the things that we said was how we saw it as an opportunity to really go as far as we were our potential would let us. It was as if we got caught up in a very strong desire and channel, if you like, and sense of service to just how much can we do, and it just kept manifesting, and then we do a bit more and a bit more and a bit more. So it was more of an incremental thing than sitting there saying, let's go for a big bang. It grew in that way as we supported and loved each other. I think we generated and brought together through spirit a group of people who came from love primarily, not fear, and were totally up for it. And yet we were the type of people who would ask forgiveness rather than seek permission. Absolutely. So we just kept finding we were breaking through barriers, and it was happening, and it was wonderful.
So there was no grand, kind of plan that says, okay, over the next 18 months, we're going to elevate everyone, we're going to do this, this, and this, and everybody's going to get here. It sounds like it was an organic kind of, well, that worked, let's do something else kind of approach.
Yeah, it was much more organic. It was much more as you're in, more in the moment, going along, and this happened, and then that happened. And we're like, hey, come on, ooh, let's have a go at that. I don't think any of us would sit there and say we had a big grand plan. We had a lot of love, a lot of commitment, a total passion to serve the learners who were coming through our programs. We wanted the FE sector, the community colleges in America, to be the best that they could be through supporting the leaders. Everybody was like that in the organization. We really cared about what we were doing. So, no, I don't want to sit here saying, you know, oh, I was really the CEO with this big plan. I was as much in the emergence of it as everyone else.
Mm-hmm. When did you start?
And that's where a lot of the fun was, yeah.
Yeah. From an output basis, from sort of the, you know, numbers on the wall that the superiors can look at and say, well, I guess we should leave these folks alone. When did you start seeing the results? After you arrived there?
After about 2 years. And again, don't get me wrong, underlying this organization, and my deputy CEO was one of the best at this, we had very clear processes, good target setting processes, good monitoring processes. So all the classic and important organizational processes and structures to hold the organization in place were also there. We were not very good at a hierarchy. We were much more of a peer group. One of the things that people used to say is you can't tell where the hierarchy is in this organization. I didn't have an office. None of the senior staff had offices. We were all together in open plan. There were no perks for the seniors either. We really experimented. If people know spiral dynamics, we were really, really trying to develop that very orange culture, but also very green and yellow. Mm-hmm. So we were going for a very peer organization. Mm-hmm. So there was a whole mix in there of all sorts of things. But it was about 2 years. And actually, in the fourth year, we actually made $500,000 on top of the profit we'd already made. And when I went to the board and they said, how have you done that? I actually said, we really don't know, actually. we can't actually unpack. It's no one big thing. We think just everybody's inched their game up. So there's additional numbers all over the place and innovative things. So they just looked at me and said, you can't say you don't know. I went, okay, divine intervention. But we really had got to the point where we couldn't track some of the surges that were happening. I've never worked in an organization before or since where that's happened.
Wow.
Where we got this $500,000 appeared, and it makes it sound inept, but we were not. It was like, and when we tracked it afterwards, it was everybody had upped their game a bit again.
Yeah. Yeah. You hit on something though that was a factor there that I think when we start talking about my experiences, when I start talking about spirituality in the workplace with those in my colleagues, my friends, my associates that are in more of a traditional business setting. There sometimes is this assumption that those sorts of approaches and attitudes are an excuse for lack of structure, that, oh, it's about everybody sitting around beating on drums. And the fact that you had this very structured, you had targets, all of that just makes so much sense. And it feels to me like, well, there's a building, there's a layering process that's there, that you have to have the structures in place to appropriately hold this other sort of development that's going on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. But it doesn't restrict it.
Right.
I think structures can be a vehicle for holding,
mm-hmm.
and they can also contain in a way that restricts. We never let them restrict us. And if we came up with a process that could be broader or looser that served its purpose, we'd run with it. But we had a reason why we were doing that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Again, on spiral dynamics, we had a very healthy respect for blue, but we didn't live in blue.
Right.
You know, having some hierarchy. So we introduced structures and processes that served us, not the other way around. Now, that was the hardest thing for the civil servants to accept. because they wanted to see very traditional, hierarchical, blue processes there because they should be there.
Right.
Whether they served or not. That was the biggest place of tension between us and civil servants. And we drew lots of our things in circles, so we always had to have a linear square version for the civil servants.
Well, that's being
We talk different languages to different audiences to meet their needs, and to be honest, for them to leave us alone.
Well, see, and that's being a spiral master there. And so I have a question I want to ask you, but before I do that, I want to remind everyone, I could go on talking for hours with Lynn, but if you have something you'd like to ask, please raise your hand, star 5, and please join in with us. While we're waiting for a brave soul, and this may be a little theoretical for this conversation, but do you need a second, just in spiral dynamic language for a moment, do you need second tier leadership in order to make this sort of thing happen?
Okay, my experiences, I think you do. Mm-hmm. I worked for 15 years with Bill Talbot as well, so had looked at his action logics. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we did do in Cell, Don Beck came and worked with us, and I was using as a chief exec action logics. So we did have leadership programs in every action logic, technician, achiever, individualist, and it used to be magician, wasn't it, and alchemist. So we provided leadership development programs for wherever individuals were at on those action logics. Mm-hmm. And that's why we brought 40,000 people through, because the leaders in our sector who came into contact with us would go, oh, that's just right for me. Oh, that just fits for me.
Right, right.
And I do work as a post-conventional leader consciously, and have done since 1989, using Bill Talbot's frame. And then Don Beck came and worked with us as well. And I believe that my team, the six of my SMT, that we were all post-conventionals.
Yeah.
Or second tier, or you know, in between transitioning first and second tier. And I think that made a huge difference.
Was that team in place when you arrived? Did you go out and assemble that team with that idea?
I assembled the team.
Yeah.
And we talked in those. We used spiral dynamics and more than the Talbot action logic, though, to talk about how we related to others and stakeholders. And because we had a shadow side too. We looked into our own shadow side. Don Beck came and worked with us to really help us to look at that and get what that shadow side was. And some of that was arrogance and impatience and not really perhaps thinking others were as good as us. So, you know, we needed to work with that as well.
Sure.
Which we did.
So I think I know the rest of the CEL story, and I don't know that it's a very happy one. But what happened towards the end of what ended up happening?
No, well, what actually happened is, in our sector, they had to simplify agencies, and there was another agency that was much bigger than ours that really wasn't succeeding. So they asked, they merged the two organisations together. Really, on one level, wanting the Cell energy to go and transform the other organisation, which was very blue, very bureaucratic, and operated from fear, a very strong fear base. Mm-hmm. And since that time, there's actually been the burning of the Quangos. So about 70 national Quangos have actually had to merge or be got rid of. So there was nothing particular against Cell at the time. We were just part of that development. I was asked to go for the new CEO job, but I just did not want to go into leading a low-level blue-based organisation and to bring it through back up into orange, green and yellow. Yeah. It was a huge task. Don Beck came and worked with us and basically said, well, several other consultants were brought in and they all said, don't merge them. The DNA is just enough, not just don't merge these two organisations. But it was a political merger, right. And so they did merge it. But I decided at that point to move on, as did quite a few of the sales staff. And the new organisation has had 5 chief execs in 18 months. Because I've been 2 years, 5 chief execs.
So there's a question, and I don't have a name, but the last 4 digits of the telephone number are 2444. I've unmuted you, and welcome.
Hi, Lynn. It's Ian here from the UK.
Hello.
Hi. Absolutely fascinated. Love your story. Always love listening to you on this. What would it take, Lynn, given the successful track record of CEL and the current increase in rate of complexity and speed of change, where we need more advanced models of leadership? What would it take for government today to take a leap of faith and recreate a training organization for these models of leadership that we need?
Okay, my experience, because as Tom mentioned, I then went on, after the cell job, I went on to be part of the Prime Minister's review of the whole of public sector leadership, and to look at the £800 million investment that's made in leadership in the UK. One of the things that was recommended was that the whole issue of looking at more complexity, of looking at leaders who are able to look at the system, to think systemically, all of that was raised in the review. All of that was taken forward. What has since happened, though, since the coalition government's come in, has been huge savings. So I think at the moment, the sense of all of that extra development has kind of dropped down a level, and people are saying they need financial management, they need to know how to downsize, they need to know how to be managers. So there is what has happened is a kind of drop in the perception of what's needed, because people have gone into fear and panic about survival, essentially.
Sure. Right.
Now, I think there is a period with the post-riots, for those of you in America who are not aware, we've had this incredible series of riots that have gone right throughout our country. And I think there's a new inquiry that's beginning to take place about how can we do it differently, because leaders are struggling because of the level of complexity. Mm-hmm. And Keith Grint does a lot of work in the UK about wicked issues, highly complex wicked issues. So it might be that it was the riots that took for them to look at it differently.
Mm-hmm. Great question. Thank you so much for that. You know, it's this dynamic, and it's certainly happening in many different forms and many different places around the world, that in these times of great challenge and change, the first reaction is oftentimes to go into a place of retrenchment, survival, fear. But those are also the very times that we need more of this approach, don't we? I mean, the very key to get us through is the one we fear turning in the lock.
I mean, I'm doing a really interesting piece of work with Eve Middleton, who's a professor of complexity at the London School of Economics. And she is doing some really interesting work. Now, people listen to the LSE. It's a very prestigious organisation. So I think there are some post-conventional academics and thinkers, as well as practitioners in the system, who are beginning to step forward. And she's certainly doing some very interesting work about assisting people practically to deal with complexity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think there are pockets of key things that are happening that will start to join up. If they don't literally join up, they'll start to affect the system and take it hopefully to another stage. She's just one example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, anything else that you're working on now or interested in or following that pertains to the same subject?
Well, one of the things I'm wanting to do, I'm talking to Don Beck and the team of people in England who are very involved in spiral dynamics, to take part of my job at the moment is to take propositions to senior ministers about how things can be different, primarily on educational policy, but to actually see how we can offer a spiral dynamics perspective and proposition around post the riots. And certainly in some of the leadership networks that I'm involved in, and we've just produced a document about leading, teaching and learning, and I'm working on a project within further education that will be looking again at leadership that's actually able to cope with more complexity. Leading in difficult times is something that we're looking at as well. And I know that the Cabinet Office is always looking for solutions and ideas. I think the problem you've got is you haven't got enough post-conventionals or second-tier leaders in senior enough positions who can actually take that work forward to where it really needs to be.
Right.
And that's the task, I think, to develop more leaders. And that's what that review was trying to do. And a couple of the permanent secretaries are definitely in later stage or transitioning level. So I think it's finding where they are and piecing the work together and lots of projects. And I know there's lots of people in England who are working at second tier or post-conventional levels to find ways of influencing the mainstream system.
When you run into those people, do they tend to know?
My experience when we were doing the review for it was Gordon Brown, it was fascinating because you mention a few names, you mention spiral dynamics, you say post-conventional, you say second tier. There's some of those words actually that the other person lights up at and goes, Have you read that? And then you start to realise that you're looking at the world in a similar way,
right.
And then to share the concepts. I met about four permanent secretaries, which is very senior levels and very influential in the civil service. And there's another amazing project that's taking place with five different countries looking at how very senior civil servants lead differently.
Yeah.
And I was asked to go and do a presentation on post-conventional leadership to them. Now, half the room didn't get it, and half the room got very excited, Eve Middleton being one of those. So yes, it's almost like there's a recognition. You know when you meet each other.
Yeah, and there's a secret handshake, right?
Yeah.
So I've got another call. I mean, somebody else wants to. This will probably be the last one we'll have time for today, but it's a phone number ending with 7683. And I think I've unmuted you. Give it just a second. Somebody there? No, let me try it again. There we go. I didn't click.
Okay. Joe Meek is from New Jersey.
Hello.
My question, hello. Are there any other models that you looked into or use other than spiral dynamics?
Okay, the ones that I've used are spiral dynamics, Talbot's action logic, Bill Talbot's action logic, which is based on Lovinger's ego development stages. The framework that I absolutely love and has really helped me to change more than anything is the Enneagram. Mm. I'm an eight, a social eight with a seven wing on the Enneagram. The Enneagram's been fantastic. I've used Myers-Briggs and NLP in organisations as well. I am currently studying complexity theory, which I'm finding really, really helpful. And other than that, I tended to look at leadership frameworks. Keith Grint's work, Professor Keith Grint, who's now at Warwick University, has done a load of work around wicked issues, looking at really complex issues and how we work together to deal with them. And I read leadership books avidly. But certainly spiral dynamics, action logics, and the Enneagram are the three. And then really the Ridwan School's form of inquiry, using repeating questions, constantly inquiring, action inquiry, being in the moment, and then other spiritual practices, being present, mindful, are really, I suppose, my core tools.
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the call.
So what a wonderful, I'm sitting here thinking, gosh, I sure wished I was in that organization when all this was going on. What a wonderful.
I wish we were still in it.
Yeah.
We did do a cell book. We did this wonderful book where people wrote, if they wanted to, what it had been like being in cell. And we call it our blue book. And it was lovely. People said what they got out of it. People wrote poems. People wrote songs for it. It was lovely. It's a wonderful celebratory book. Yeah.
You got an example or two of where maybe some seeds have been planted, where some folks have come out of that environment and now are doing the same kind of work in other places?
Yeah. I mean, basically, there are still about 30 people in the new organization, which is called LCIS, and they're doing fabulous work in there. And then about 20 of us also went into other sector organisations. We still meet up for dinner, and we still talk to each other, and we still email each other and are supportive to each other. And people have gone in, and what they've done is taken the spirit of cell. When we kind of ended, in a way, everybody had a silver star paperweight, and we bought a star in the sky. So we left because they were saying everybody was such a star and wonderful. And the starfish became, there's a wonderful book called The Spider and the Starfish, which we liked. And so we went away with this emblem of the star and the starfish. And people were going off to make their own contribution, which is what they've done. I mean, the upside is people have gone away with that spirit, knowing what was possible, and have taken it into other organizations.
Right.
And the Book of Cell is being written at the moment, actually. Jodie Fry is writing the Book of Cell as a case study, because another model that I should have mentioned was Jodie Fry's spiritual leadership model. We use that to look at how we were in terms of staff's inner life and spirituality. So Jodie Fry's got a wonderful spiritual leadership model. He's a professor at Texas A&T University. That's another model that I really like.
So it's not so much necessarily that cell, went away, as it's evolved. Its DNA has perhaps been taken apart, and now it's being planted elsewhere, and its work goes on in wonderful ways, it sounds like. So
that was the metaphor that worked for us.
Yeah.
But being human, we wanted to hang on to it. Quite a few of us have done Buddhist practice for non-attachment, and we would sit there and say, it's not working. We feel really attached, but we had to rise above it in the end.
Yeah.
Well, and if you trust and accept, things change and move.
That's right.
And your ego has to let go.
Yeah.
But it wasn't easy.
Humans love form, and we just get real attached. So that's understandable.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. Well, that feels like a very nice, a very uplifting, positive place to wrap up. Any final thoughts before we sign off today? What will you be, do you know, it's kind of a little ways out, but do you know what you'll be speaking about when you're in Fayetteville in November?
Yes, what Judy has asked me to do, and I'd love to do, is I'm opening it before the awards and things, is really to talk about the experience around trying and collectively living spirituality in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think my final word is it's a collective thing. It's only as good and as wonderful as all the people that are involved, and it's all about distributed leadership and empowerment at every level. And I know that's a corny word these days, but the thing that people would say in cell is, hey, you can come in here and you can really go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trusted and supported to do that, and it just feels wonderful. And our experience was people really respected that and gave it the dignity and the respect it deserved. They were wonderful, mm-hmm. Absolutely wonderful.
Well, that's fantastic. Lynn, it's been just an absolute joy to spend some time with you and to hear about your experience, and I want to thank you once again for taking time out of your evening to do that with us.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. And thank you for those who've joined us and asked questions. And I'm sure there are as many wonderful and positive and equally interesting stories of the people listening than mine as well. It's just one of many. I know that too.
And I look forward to meeting you in November when you're over.
Yeah.
And
okay, that's great.
I'll look forward to kind of seeing everyone else back on the call the 21st of September in the afternoon. I'll get an announcement out shortly about times and whatnot when we talk to Bill Pollard. So thanks again, Lynn, and I'll let you go. And just blessings
okay.
to you, and travel safe in everything you do and on your way over in November.
Okay. And love and blessings to everyone else. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.